The Katra Podcast, conversations for the curious, essential knowledge simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Welcome to the deep dive. Our mission today is really to cut through all the noise and distill some profound arguments. We're looking at critical sources about, well, a giant, really, Leo Tolstoy, a towering figure, but also deeply contradictory.
Yeah, and the sources we're digging into today, they mostly center around Liza Knapp's analysis. And her argument is, it's pretty radical, actually. It's not just about summarizing War and Peace or Anna Karenina.
Right.
Knapp's saying, essentially, that you cannot separate his huge literary output from his relentless, often painful, lifelong search for meaning, for philosophy, for spirituality. Mm-hmm. His art wasn't just, you know, inspired by his life. His novels were more like a living laboratory, a place where he was actively trying to figure out how to live a morally justifiable life.
A laboratory for living, yeah. Exactly. So the knowledge we're aiming for you, is this. How did all that crushing internal turmoil, this was a wealthy Russian count, remember, how did that fuel these universal masterpieces? And maybe more importantly, what can his struggle teach us about trying to live authentically today?
Well, the first thing that strikes me is just the authority Knapp brings to this. She's a distinguished professor, Slavic languages, knows Tolstoy and Dostoevsky inside out.
Okay.
And what's fascinating here, like you said, she's not just writing a biography. Uh-huh. That's not her main goal. She's a literary critic first, and she reads his life through the lens of his art and, you know, vice versa.
Ah, okay. So it's intertwined.
Completely. She treats the whole sweep of his existence, right from the earliest diaries, the self-criticism, to that final dramatic flight from home. She sees it all as one single integrated project.
So the writing was the spiritual journey. The novels themselves were like these high-stakes philosophical experiments.
Precisely. That's her core thesis. She says reading Tolstoy is like witnessing a soul in a state of perpetual radical inquiry. And that, I think, explains why his work still feels so urgent, so alive. He wasn't just, you know, spinning tales. He was desperately trying to figure out how to be a good person in this messy, chaotic world.
Mm.
And he used his characters, people like Pierre or Levin, to test out ideas to see how they'd hold up.
Okay, let's unpack that soul then.
Yeah.
Before we even get to War and Peace, we need to understand the engine driving him. Knapp calls it his maximalism.
Yes, maximalism.
Which sounds intense. It means he just couldn't do half measures.
No.
Everything pushed to the extreme.
That's it. Which resulted in, well, immense genius, obviously, but also these huge glaring contradictions in his life.
Yeah, think about those paradoxes Knapp lays out. He's born an aristocrat, a wealthy count, but later preaches this almost aggressive poverty, wanting everyone to live simply.
Right, demanding it almost.
And he was clearly a sensual man, fathered 13 children, yet later becomes this fierce advocate for universal celibacy.
A total flip.
And the big one, world famous novelist, creator of these epics, who eventually turns around and condemns his own masterpieces. Says they're, what, morally harmful trifles?
Mm-hmm. Morally irrelevant at best, harmful at worst. This tendency, this need to push everything to its absolute moral limit, never settling for compromise, that is his maximalism.
Okay.
And Knapp shows the roots go way back. His early diaries, I mean, incredibly early, he's meticulously documenting every moral failing, gambling, lust, vanity.
He was really hard on himself.
Oh, incredibly. And that habit, that practice became the cornerstone of his whole literary method, this radical self-analysis.
So he was using his own life as raw material for self-improvement, like a kind of brutal personal audit, long before he was using it for fiction.
Exactly. The psychological engine was already running full tilt.
And then that self-auditing tool gets applied to the outside world, doesn't it? During his military service, the Crimean War.
A huge turning point, yes.
Yes.
That experience led directly to the Sevastopol sketches. And this is where he really sharpens that signature technique, what the source calls defamiliarized realism.
Right. Defamiliarized realism. For you listening, that basically means he takes something familiar, like the supposed glory of war, and he forces you to see it completely fresh.
Like you've never seen it before.
Yeah. Strips away all the romance, all the heroism, and shows you the brutal, messy, sometimes boring reality, suffering, logistics, fear.
It was shocking stuff back then. Completely overturned the conventions of war writing. But yeah, that defined his style from then on, that unflinching honesty.
So he figures out how this incredibly honest, realistic style out there in the field, in the war. But to tackle the sheer scale of War and Peace or Anna Karenina, he needed something else. Stability.
That's a big part of it.
Yeah.
We connect this to the bigger picture. the stability he found, at least for a time, in his marriage to Sophia was crucial.
The wife, yeah.
And she wasn't just a wife. She was his indispensable copyist, right? Mm-hmm. Transcribing thousands of pages of his incredibly messy drafts multiple times.
I can't even imagine the patience. She was basically his first editor too, wasn't she?
Absolutely. That partnership, however fraught it became later, provided the bedrock for those golden years of writing. But again, even those novels weren't, you know, cozy domestic stories. They were philosophical battlegrounds.
Okay, so let's talk War and Peace. Knapp shows how the characters are like stand-ins for his own quest, his own questions.
Definitely. Look at Pierre Bezukhov.
Right. The awkward, searching intellectual, always trying to figure things out.
Exactly. He's clearly a vehicle for Tolstoy's own wrestling with big ideas, history, meaning destiny. And the novel itself challenges that whole great man theory of history, doesn't it?
Yeah, the idea that Napoleon or Tsar Alexander are the ones driving events, Tolstoy seems to say it's much messier than that.
Much messier. This is where we get that fascinating Russian concept. Knapp discusses Rovo.
Rovo. Swarm life.
Form life, exactly. The novel suggests that true meaning, and maybe even the direction of history itself, isn't found in grand theories or heroic leaders. It's found in simple acts, family connections, the land.
Mm-hmm.
And this intuitive, almost non-rational, collective force, like a swarm of bees, infinitesimally small actions, creating a larger movement. It's profoundly anti-heroic, really.
So forget Napoleon. Look at the unnoticed soldier, the family dinner.
Look at the collective, chaotic, instinctive movement of ordinary people. That's where the truth lies, for Tolstoy in War and Peace.
And that tension in the book, The Intellectual Search Versus the Intuitive Life, it feels like it's setting the stage for his own crisis, doesn't it? Which we see really brewing in Anna Karenina.
Oh, absolutely. It's foreshadowing. Anna Karenina is often seen as, you know, the great novel of adultery.
Right. Tragic love affair.
But Knapp argues pretty convincingly, I think, that it's really a staging ground for his massive spiritual breakdown that was coming. Well, you have Anna's passionate, all-consuming, ultimately destructive pursuit of romantic love. And that's contrasted so sharply with Constantin Levin.
Levin. Right. Who is basically Tolstoy, right? A very thin veil.
Almost transparently so. Levin is awkward. He struggles with managing his estate. He feels out of place in high society. But most importantly, he's on this agonizing search for faith, meaning through family, through physical labor on the land.
His difficult, imperfect search. It sounds like Tolstoy projecting his own internal battle onto the page.
Completely. He's wrestling with that fundamental question, what can life really be built on? What foundation holds? And that famous opening line.
All happy families are alike. Each unhappy family is unhappy in its own way.
That line kicks off his deepest dive yet into those foundations. It shows his maximalist drive turning inward, focusing more and more on this need for, well, for spiritual certainty, which eventually leads to renunciation.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting, because that brewing crisis just explodes, doesn't it? Late 1870s.
Total implosion.
He writes about it in that incredibly raw memoir, A Confession. Here he is, peak of his fame, rich, respected worldwide, and he's on the verge of suicide. Utter despair.
Yeah.
Now wait, if he was so committed to truth, to self-analysis all along, why did it take until his 50s for this massive break? Was it a breakdown, pure and simple? Or was it almost a calculated maximalist move to finally force his life to match his ideals?
That's a great question. And Knapp seems to read it as, well, both. It was undeniably a psychological crisis fueled by profound despair.
Right.
He genuinely concluded that nothing, not science, not philosophy, not even his own celebrated art could answer that terrifyingly simple question. What is the meaning of my life?
The ultimate question.
But his response to that despair was absolutely a maximalist move. No half measures.
So what was the response?
He found his answer, or thought he did, in the simple, unshakable faith of the Russian peasants, which led him to radically reject the official Orthodox Church, renounce his property, his title, everything, and formulate his own brand of radical Christian anarchism. Based on the Sermon on the Mount, really, key to this was non-resistance to evil with violence, five central tenets derived from the Gospels. This wasn't just a private belief system. It was a public call to transform society.
But this total conversion, it must have caused chaos at home. With his family?
Oh, spectacular tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
His wife, Sophia, who supported him, copied his manuscripts, managed the household for decades. She fought him tooth and nail.
Understandably, maybe. She's trying to protect her children's inheritance, his literary legacy.
Exactly. And she saw his main disciple, Vladimir Chertkov, as this zealous manipulator trying to basically steal Tolstoy's legacy, the battle over his diaries, the rights to his works, his estate. It became this bitter public war within the family.
So his final years weren't peaceful enlightenment.
Far from it, defined by this awful, intolerable conflict, which ultimately culminates in that final act, him secretly fleeing his home, Yasnaya Polyana, at age 82.
A final desperate attempt to align his physical life with his extreme moral beliefs.
It's the ultimate tragedy of the maximalist, isn't it? You push everything so far.
It breaks, yeah. And Knapp narrates his death shortly after, from pneumonia, at that remote railway station, Ostapovo, as this incredibly poignant, very public end to a life that was defined by such intense, relentless private searching. His life itself became the final tragic masterpiece.
Wow. Okay. So that's a huge, heavy story. Yeah. How do we take this titanic struggle and make it relevant for us, for you listening? Knapp's analysis seems to offer some powerful takeaways rooted in that maximalist quest.
I think so. Several key insights emerge.
Okay, first up, maybe the courage of radical authenticity. Those diaries, filled with really unflattering self-criticism, his constant resolutions to be better, it feels like a call for just radical honesty with oneself.
Absolutely.
We live now, don't we, in an age of like curated online personas, Instagram filters on reality. Tolstoy's antidote seems to be, you have to build on a foundation of total, relentless self-scrutiny.
Even when it's ugly. Especially when it's ugly. Being honest with yourself, even the uncomfortable bits, that's the only ground for actual moral growth.
That resonates. And theme two. Questioning societal norms. Tolstoy had this deep, ingrained suspicion of civilized elite society. He saw it as fundamentally vain, hypocritical, morally bankrupt.
Right. All surface, no substance.
He was constantly asking why. Yeah. Why do we live like this? Why do we accept these structures, these expectations? And maybe we should apply that same skepticism today.
To what? Like consumer culture?
Careerism.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Ask. Do these pressures, these things we chase, actually align with a meaningful, authentic life? Or are they just the kind of Vanity Fair that Tolstoy ultimately rejected so forcefully? It's a powerful lens for critiquing our own time.
Okay. And a third theme. Maybe something about his art itself.
I think so. Theme three, the power of empathy and perspective taking. That literary method we talked about, the defamiliarized realism honed in the Crimean War. It wasn't just a technique. It forces the reader, doesn't it, to truly inhabit the consciousness of vastly different people. Yeah, you're inside the head of a soldier one minute, a peasant the next, then Anna, then Levin.
And that skill, which Knapp analyzes so well, that's a practice for us.
Yeah.
Actively trying to practice that kind of deep perspective taking, forcing yourself to see the world through eyes that are not your own.
And the application is breaking down that us versus them mentality. Fostering compassion.
Precisely. It feels essential for any kind of real moral action or understanding in a divided world. Mm-hmm. It's the imaginative muscle he flexed constantly.
So ultimately, Knapp's work really drives home that the universal power of Tolstoy's art. It wasn't this serene gift from above.
Not at all.
It was forged in the fire, wasn't it? The fire of his own contradictions, his spiritual agony, and this relentless, unyielding demand for an authentic, morally coherent life. He just refused to compartmentalize.
That refusal is key.
That unyielding demand. That's what stays with you, I think. His struggle feels like our struggle, just, you know, amplified to an almost unbearable degree, the maximalist degree.
It really does. Yeah. And it's worth remembering, you know, Tolstoy's late life philosophy, especially that idea of non-resistance to evil, it had a huge impact.
Yeah.
It profoundly influenced people like Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr.
Right. Two giants of the 20th century.
So here's a final thought maybe for you to mull over.
Yeah.
What does Tolstoy's ultimate example, the fact that he felt compelled to sacrifice his wealth, his art, even his family harmony, in the end, what does that imply about the personal cost that might be required to achieve that kind of lasting moral influence on a global scale?
Yeah.
It's a sobering question, isn't it?
It really is. A heavy price for that kind of conviction.
Indeed.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.